Good afternoon and welcome aboard. Happy Wednesday to you. John McGinnis with you, News Radio KPK. Hope you're having a great day. Lots of things going on today. We're going to have a largely law enforcement conversation today because there's so much going on. I've been trying to get to for the last several days into some specific details that I think drive the statistical data, which is favorable news for people who live or own businesses in the unincorporated area of Sacramento County. We'll drill down on that, get some of the specifics, and talk to a man who played a significant role in achieving a 10% drop in violent crime in Sacramento County, while the rest of the state had, and frankly across the nation, there was data going in the exact opposite direction. We'll drill down and see exactly what factors came into play there, how that was realized. That's coming up second half of the program. But there's a couple of other things popping in the news of significance. Sad stories, both of them. Rockland police officer is now a criminal defendant in an excessive force case, which would be assault of behavior under a color of authority, and apparently falsifying police reports. I have not seen the video, obviously. I have no desire to see the video. But apparently that was a part of the evidence that was used to reach the determination that caused the district attorney to file criminal charges and for the police chief to make a public statement on this. And I've got calls today from people in the media asking, isn't this rare? Isn't this unusual? Well, it really, frankly, the conduct is. But the in terms of misconduct on the part of a law enforcement officer where the complaint, the source of the complaint is internal to the organization, is not unusual. In fact, that is the norm. There was a period of time in my organization in which 90%, I think that standard probably stays today, 90% of the complaints of misconduct on the part of officers was self-generated. In other words, within the organization. So this, I think, myth that exists that asserts that law enforcement covers up and circles the wagons and is not inclined to do the right thing and take care of business when somebody breaks bad, it's not supported by the facts. And in this particular case, as I understand it, hearing the chief's message in Rockland, the source of the complaint was internal to the organization. Other people with other officers saw the conduct and brought a complaint forward. Evidence was reviewed and criminal charges have been filed. The officer has been named. And I would assume that his career is going to be short-lived. And understand a couple of things. People ask questions. Why is it that oftentimes you hear about allegations of misconduct on the part of a law enforcement officer and the identity of that officer is not published? Well, under the Peace Officers or Public Safety Officers Bill of Rights, the employing entity is not allowed to disclose the name or photograph of a person suspected of or subject to an investigation for misconduct in the course and scope of their duties. That's a privilege extended to public safety officers under the law, that they shall not be identified. All of that changes when it becomes a criminal case. So in this particular case, the Placer County District Attorney's Office has filed a criminal complaint, and therefore it becomes public information. As to what is likely to come of the administrative investigation, that is to say what the police department is going to do with this particular individual, that would still enjoy the benefit of the Peace Officers Bill of Rights and will not be subject to disclosure to the public. So two different standards in two different arenas. And by the way, the standard for a conviction in a criminal case is still beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond and to the exclusion of any reasonable doubt, effectively to a moral certainty. That's what the DA will be faced with when this matter goes to trial. You have to prove to a jury of the defendant's peers, and that's who this officer will be at that time, a criminal defendant, prove to that standard, to a jury of the defendant's peers, that he did act in a criminal way. And in this particular case, it's not just the conduct, it is the state of mind, because there are times, certainly, when a law enforcement officer, or anybody for that matter, may legally use force up to and including deadly force against another human being lawfully if the person using such force can articulate a reasonable fear for their safety or that of innocent persons. And so think about it. To overcome resistance, law enforcement officers are in a unique position where, yes, force is oftentimes going to be used. There's also the term excessive force, which is not always going to be criminal. excessive can be just ever so slightly beyond what would be expected, what the standard would be, what's necessary and reasonable, not necessarily amounting to criminal when you get into areas of brutality and assault under color of authority. So that's all the different dynamics that come into play. And that's why in this particular case, you do see the name and photograph of the officer published, because that is under the banner of a criminal defendant facing prosecution. But I think it's worthy of note that the source of the complaint was internal, other police officers who brought the complaint forward. And that is not the exception to the rule. And I think it's surprising for people to hear that. It's the most common source of complaints of law enforcement misconduct. Now, another case that is obviously very much in real time right now is this down in Emeryville, where a homicide suspect who led police on a chase onto a very, very busy Interstate 80 in the East Bay has now been shot dead. And that was during a tense freeway standoff with police that had halted traffic in both directions for a period of time. The Richmond Police Department was pursuing the suspect's blacked SUV. It looks to be a Suburban westbound on Interstate 80 around 9 o'clock this morning, when CHP officers successfully used a spike strip on the vehicle at University Avenue. I actually got out ahead of it and deployed the spike strip. It had the desired effect, brought the vehicle to a stop in what looks to be the number 3 lane. Suspect at one point apparently put his hands outside the window of the SUV, and then ultimately, after a protracted period of time, opened the door and came out. It looks as though, if you see the video, and it is posted at the KPK website, it looks as though he came out hunched over, and you can't clearly see it, but it's consistent with what witnesses have told law enforcement, had the gun in his hand. And if you look, there's a phalanx of law enforcement vehicles right behind the suspect vehicle. And he came out with a gun at the ready. And by the way, simply having the weapon in his possession at that time, in the context of all this, would be sufficient for them to clearly be able to recognize and articulate a threat to their safety and the safety of the motoring public around there. As you look at this video, there's a split. The freeway actually splits at that point. And so as it appears obvious that a traffic block was used to stop traffic. And there's a couple of different dimensions on this you see from an aviation platform, where you can see that there's greater distance than you see from a cell phone video that creates the impression that the opposing lanes of traffic are much, much closer to the suspect vehicle than the aerial footage would indicate. When I've had questions come up, why there? Well, they don't pick the time. They used a widely recognized means to communicate to him to pull over and stop and comply with their lawful instructions. He failed to yield, was increasing his threat to the safety of the public by doing so on a busy freeway. And a level of force vis-a-vis spike strip was used. It had the desired outcome, stopped the truck, the Suburban. And at that point, he had a lot of options, The most advisable would have been to comply with their lawful instructions, step out of the vehicle with his hands up and be taken into custody. And he could face due process and hope for the best outcome from his perspective. Well, he chose otherwise and put the police in a position where they appear to have exercised their right to protect themselves and respected their duty to protect others as this played out. Now, remember, this is what they know or reasonably believe at this point. They believe that he is wanted for a murder, so he has shown his propensity for committing the ultimate crime. Now he's armed. He's in a densely populated area. He's failing to comply. He had just engaged in a vehicle pursuit, which is a violent act unto itself. So all the background, all of the ingredients in this thing created an environment in which it seems very reasonable to conclude that that their fear, concern, was reasonable, and they therefore used force to stop his threat to the safety of those around him. You got thoughts on it? 916-921-1530, 800-834-1530. get your thoughts on that after we take care of some other business very quickly. Then we're going to talk to the chief from the Sheriff's Department, who was an integral part of imposing a style and method of policing that apparently has had tremendous success. We'll get all that coming up after this. Don't go away.
Hey.
First, for breaking news, 24/7. Depend on it. News Radio KFBK.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying on board. John McGinnis with you. News Radio KFBK. Lots of law enforcement stuff going on, and we are talking a little bit about the incident in Emeryville that's still very dynamic, still ongoing. I should say the investigation is, so you can expect traffic impact in the area because of that. And there will be questions as to why that location, why was it done the way it was. Well, honestly, to a great extent, the violator, the suspect, chooses the location. It's up to law enforcement to play the hand they're dealt. And I think that's what you're seeing having developed there. The other conversation, of course, is out of the Rockland Police Department, and I do not know any of the specific details on that whatsoever. And if I did, I wouldn't share them, certainly. I don't want to know. I have no need to know. I want the jury in that case to see and hear that evidence pristine for the first time. In the context of due process of law, that's how things are supposed to work, and we should respect that system. I think this is classic in terms of that. The police department has undertaken their duties as they're expected to do. The district attorney's office has exercised their obligation in terms of making decisions with regard to filing. That's in motion now, and let it go where it may. But interesting to note is the fact that, as is typically the case, the complaints on this were not generated from the community, but rather from within law enforcement. It was the peers, the colleagues of the officer, now a criminal defendant, who made the complaint. And I think that creates an impression vastly different than what many critics and many in the media, frankly, would have people believe in terms of the nature of law enforcement, the open, objective, fair nature of law enforcement versus a kind of a circle the wagons mentality that you hear suggested oftentimes. So let's get your thoughts, shall we? 916-921-1530, 800-834-1530. After we take care of some other business, we are going to be joined by Chris Palmer, chief with the Sacramento Sheriff's Department. He's going to talk about, I think, some bragging rights and some very, very good data that has come out showing that depending upon where you live or own a business, you may be enjoying an improved sense of safety based upon crime data that contradicts trends statewide and even beyond the state of California. So we'll get to that after the bottom of the hour. Let's get your calls. So let's check in with Brett in Carmichael. Brett, good afternoon. Welcome to the conversation.
Yes, good afternoon, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I just want to tell you thank you. I appreciate the comments that you've been making for those of us in law enforcement. Huh. I've been law enforcement for 25 years, and there's a little thing called failure to report that the public might not be aware about.
Right, right.
That all of us are We're bound to uphold the law, and, you know, they might not realize this, but you know who dislikes the dirty cop the most?
Yes,
the rest
I do.
Of the cops.
Yep, absolutely
because
true.
Because it makes us look bad.
Absolutely
and,
true. By the way, that's a concept that not every profession or calling seems to share. There does seem to be a circle-the-wagons mentality that exists in other professions, vocations, and callings that I'm at a loss to understand, because as a very proud veteran of law enforcement, I like to extol the virtue and talent of the good people that's representative of the majority of the profession. But for those who breach that trust, who break bad and do horrible things, I want to resolve things properly. I want them locked up. And so I understand exactly where you're coming from.
Yeah, and for 25 years, it's you know, anyone, the dirty cop is the one we don't want in there.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what they don't also realize with that failure to report, I'm never going to jeopardize my career,
right,
my life, my retirement. They don't realize how much we have riding on the line. If I see something like that and I don't report it, I'm just as guilty.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate you throwing that out because I think, you know, a lot of people, we need to, you know, respect what our law enforcement officers do.
Yep.
And for us. And I think we've gone way too far in the attitudes that we have currently, and I'm just glad you brought that up.
Well, I appreciate the call very much, Brett. I thank you for what you do and the good service you provide, and yeah, I think your thoughts are frankly shared by the vast majority within the profession. So appreciate the call. And yeah, that's, and by the way, as you look at this particular case, among the charges, as I understand it, is falsifying a police report. Well, if that's the case, that individual, if this is found to be true, that individual is of no value to the criminal justice system. He's absolutely impeachable on the stand. And that's the other thing that good law enforcement officers understand. You can end your career abruptly when you take your credibility away. And only you can take that away from you. Much more conversation coming up after this, including unlocking the secrets to why it's safer now to live in Sacramento County than it was before, and safer than some of the surrounding areas. All that coming up. Don't go away.
Join me, Dan Minchinson, along with Amy Lewis for your first look at the day's news. Plus, we'll put traffic and weather together for you. Every 10 minutes, it starts tomorrow at 5 a.m. on the KFBK Morning News.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying on board. John McGinnis with your News Radio KFBK. We oftentimes, we consistently seem to have bad news with regard to law and justice, quality of life in the various communities because of a fear of crime and violence, which is, over the years, I've been able to say, that's oftentimes hyped. But as you look at trends on a statewide basis and many of the jurisdictions within the state of California, extraordinary, exponential increases, explosion of criminal data, violent crime in particular. And just this week, as I'm perusing data, I see that there's some good news. In fact, it's very good news. The city of Sacramento saw a small drop in violent crime, about 2%, nearly 2% from last year this time. But that's following several years of dramatic increases. But in the unincorporated parts of the county of Sacramento, patrolled by the sheriff's department, the data is very, very, very impressive. Violent crime down 10.3%, and property crime down 9.2%. That's in spite of some serious complications in the law and things that have changed, resources that have gone by the wayside. So I talked to Sheriff Jones, and I said, hey, I want to give you bragging rights. Tell me, I got my own theories. I think a part of it is passive policing really, truly compromises the war on crime. If you have law enforcement officers that are reluctant to get out of their cars and engage with the community, and as you look at trends across the country, you can see why that may be the case, you're going to have a problem. My sense is that institutionally within the sheriff's department, that problem doesn't exist. They're engaged. They're working proactively to resolve community problems. But the sheriff pointed out to me that there's a concept known as intelligence-led policing that has played a dramatic role in the changes that have taken place for the positive, and that the leader of that enterprise, that effort within the sheriff's department, is none other than Chief Chris Palmer. So we have Chief Palmer here this afternoon. Good afternoon. Well, thanks for joining us, and welcome to the conversation.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. Mm-hmm. So you get some great strokes from the big boss.
Appreciate that.
And the data is pretty compelling.
Absolutely.
Tell us about intelligence-led policing. What does it mean?
Well, what it means to us is just basically all the calls that come in for 911 calls or non-emergency calls or even emails, for that matter, goes into a database. And what it does is it compiles, and then we can redistribute resources to those areas to combat those problems depending on what the crime is.
So that's there's an element, I assume, of crime pattern analysis in that, correct?
Correct.
And when I first started looking at this a decade or so ago, I was impressed with the relative precision with which a good crime analyst could predict where things were going to occur. And I was impressed. I mean, down to in this several block area, there will be a theft of high dollar golf clubs.
Correct.
And guess what? It happened.
It does.
And so the ability to glean that data and then saturate your enforcement efforts accordingly?
Absolutely. What they do is they have so many different programs the analysts use. They plug all that information in there through, modus operandi, description, time of day of the week, and then we focus those efforts for that, and they could actually do some sort of prediction as to when the next one's going to happen. And I would deploy resources into that area to try to pick off cars or suspicious person walking down the street. Maybe it's a car burglary, a trend, an uptick in the car burglaries, and, put some resources in that area to sit around and see what happens.
But through all of this, it seems to me that, data is great to have. Mm-hmm. And understanding the value that comes from that ability to virtually predict where things are going to happen. But it still requires creating an environment in which law enforcement officers are motivated to get out and go to work. And I have seen a chill in that regard across the country and throughout the state of California in recent years. And in fact, I'll tell you very candidly, I know I look at data all the time, and I look at areas where you can track to actually see a reduction in fine revenue, which tells me that, for example, traffic citations have plummeted in the state of California. And I never would advance the idea of issuing citations to raise revenue, but it's a way to capture the trends. And more importantly, the behavior change that comes from issuing traffic citations is lost. And now we see for the first time in a long time, you see an uptick in traffic fatalities. So it occurs to me that the passive policing is fundamentally dangerous to a community. And somehow it looks as though you have been able to overcome that in your jurisdiction.
Absolutely. What's most important about this is that back in about 2014, the sheriff and his executive staff worked with the Board of Supervisors to get us additional funding to increase our patrol staffing. And with that, we wanted to reorganize our patrols, both north and south of the river, to put them in what we call a team policing model.
Right.
So we put all the officers, and we did it back in the day when I was in patrol in the late 90s, early 2000s. But we did it a different way this time. We actually put a lot more thought and effort and analytical data into its utilization. And with putting that there, we put more accountability with additional watch commanders, lieutenants, managers, and sergeants. So now each team is run by a sergeant, three sergeants generally, and a lieutenant. And the accountability, so if I decided, hey, I need you to focus in this specific area, and lieutenant, I need you to get this done, develop a solution to the problem. And so what we did with that, with team policing, on 3 days a week, we had overlap days where we had twice the amount of patrol officers out there. And then you add the accountability into it. So now not only could we attack problems, and it could be from anywhere from, you know, the broken windows to vandalism to robberies to whatever it may be, narcotics trafficking, all the way down to passing out flyers in the middle of the night because we had car burglars at 1 o'clock in the morning in a specific area. So we were able to do so many things. And then in addition, proactivity went up. And so when you have officers that are out there engaged in the community and want to solve problems and have what I just consider the effort behind it to go contact people, just high visibility, talking to people, it develops intelligence, information, it lets people know we care. And then we got community buy-in. So a lot of our community meetings, a lot more people would come out, provide even additional information. So it exploded, really. I saw things in the last two years that I was at North Patrol. I saw things that officers would never have done back when I was in patrol in the late 90s. The effort, the thought, the fact that they would get out and, you know, check door handles during at business complexes just to make sure they were locked. I mean, it's all part of the community-oriented policing, and I have to give all the credit to the sheriff and the men and women, really, that are out there in the streets, both north, south, and east of this county, that do all the legwork of this thing because they actually care, and it's pretty incredible.
Well, it also, I think, is important to create a culture, maintain a culture where, face it, every time, you know, from your days as a practitioner in the field, every time you get out of that patrol car, the risk is there for a conflict that's going to break bad. People generally don't like to do business with law enforcement when they're a violator of any kind, a suspect in a serious criminal incident or some kind of a minor infraction. Either way, they're not pleased or anything in between. So what we have seen, and by way of a trend across the country in recent years, is such overt hostile criticism of policing. And the presumption is that the person who is detained, cited, or arrested by law enforcement is a victim. Mm-hmm. And as a law enforcement officer, that's the aggressor. Mm-hmm. So as a result, I really truly believe, and I talk to practitioners all around the state, and I get the same feedback. Hey, you know what? We're kind of counting time. We're marking time here. And there's a hostile environment. We don't want to be a part of it. We don't want to succumb to it. So, yeah, we'll respond when there's a problem. We'll do the best we can to resolve issues and document incidents of criminal activity. But every time that happens, it really truly is, to some extent, a failure because opportunities along the way to stop that from happening, to prevent it, have been lost. Mm-hmm. I think there's also, you know, I think people can come to terms with the idea that as you talk about officers going out and shaking door handles and checking an area to protect would-be victims and their property, that's noble. But you also, I think, minimize the likelihood that those who are maybe living on the margins, maybe likely to fall into bad behavior, will do so because the mere presence of those black and whites and uniformed personnel out in the field doing what they do is a very, very positive component to a safe society in which people can enjoy their freedoms and quality of life. So
absolutely, you're 100% correct. And you know, I encourage the officers every day, whether it's an overlap day where we have a lot of patrol officers out there, or it was just a normal day, any downtime when they're not answering calls for service was not considered their downtime. It was the community's downtime. Yeah. It was basically time for them to go out and contact people to prevent the crimes and potentially, like you said, have one of those potential people that would go one way go the other just by mere contact. And one of the other things that we found out is we developed a even greater trust within the community, and we actually kind of used it almost like a marketing piece, because our officers act very professional when they go out there and they make constitutional stops and they do things within the parameters of the law and what they're supposed to do, and they're being polite and professional with people. It makes our entire law enforcement culture that much better.
I couldn't agree more. We got to take care of some other business real quick. Like, I got more questions for you.
Sure.
Don't go away. We're coming right back. Chief Chris Palmer from the Sacramento Sheriff's Department.
Sacramento's news, traffic, and weather. News Radio KFBK.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying on board. John McGinnis with you. News Radio KPK, as is. Chief Chris Palmer from the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department explaining a little bit about intelligence-led policing. And this is tremendous. I think I'm disappointed, frankly, that it didn't get more traction in terms of a news event. When you've got really, truly troubling data throughout the state of California, some jurisdictions, Burbank, 55% increase in violent crime. Riverside, 22% increase in violent crime. And then you've got what the Sacramento Bee likes to call the uncity of Sacramento, which is, as you know, of course, is a densely populated, very urban and suburban looking area that has had its share of challenges. And certainly it's plagued by the effects of Assembly Bill 109 and Propositions 47 and 57 and homelessness and poverty and all that goes with it. You've managed to be a part of an effort to reduce the violent crime rate by better than 10%. I think that's most impressive.
Thank you.
And I think the culture of the department, that's where your leadership and the leadership of Sheriff Jones and the undersheriff and the division commanders, everybody involved in that, sends a message that, this is critical. What you do is critical to the success of the community. So do it and you'll be supported. Do it within the rule of law.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the speech me and my staff, when we went through about 140 trainees over 2 years. Those are people rotating out of the jail, coming into patrol training. We'd sit down with every single one of them, go over the expectations. And probably the overarching theme of it was customer service. Was, hey, let's treat people with respect. And with that, you're going to have the total support of not only the command staff, but all the way up through the sheriff. And just go out there and do things the right way. Do things the way you've been trained. Treat people with respect, and you'll get things done. And it's been very successful.
You know, historically, when a new concept comes along, and a lot of the old salts, and I was one of them at one point, when something new comes out of some think tank and a new concept is announced, then maybe a rolling of the eyes and this isn't going to work. But as you rolled out this intelligence-led policing, what was the reaction of the personnel?
Well, I will tell you, since we had tried the team policing, which is really the biggest pushback that we got from patrol officers, was going back to team policing. Yeah. Since we weren't so successful with it back in the early 2000s, and we've put more thought into it, my role when I first took command was about 6 months before we actually implemented the program, the reorganization. I had the good fortune of being there as an assistant commander before, so I knew a lot of the tenured, so to speak, officers that pulled a lot of weight within the locker room, out in the streets, or training officers. I pulled select ones individually into my office, and I asked them to help us sell this to the troops, because they garner that respect just from being out there for so long. And I don't know if it was me or the direction we were going, or they were looking for a change themselves. However, they bought into it hook, line, and sinker, and they've done a fantastic job of really leading the charge. So I could just get out of their way and let them go do it.
So those grumpy old salts are doing good work, good police work.
Those grumpy old salts are fantastic officers.
Yeah, they are. They are. They're the best.
Absolutely.
They don't come any better. I know that very, very well.
Absolutely.
And I think as they have a chance to see this and actually see the benefits of engaging in that kind of effective policing, and they can enjoy the community more, then the reaction to them on the part of the community is positive, and that's a powerful sentiment.
Absolutely, and that's so interesting is they feel re-energized. They feel reinvigorated because they're not chasing what we like to call chasing the box, chasing a call for service. They realize that they had the autonomy, really, to take a little bit of additional time. What I like to call is do the little things better. You know, say thank you. Ask more questions. Spend some time trying to solve that problem. And you know what? If you want to take it to the next level and investigate the crime you just took a report on, I support that. So then they could work with the detectives. They could work with the DA's office. They could even write their own warrants. And so it was a total buy-in. It was a total new experience. And it made me a better leader, made me a better listener. And I think it made the officers better just putting this whole team policing and intelligence-led policing together.
So what you're saying is that you guys are doing business a lot better than I did when I was there. That's what you're saying.
I would say you were faced with some significant challenges, but I think a lot of the same people that are around are trying to do things. We're trying to do things differently. We can do them better, that's even better.
You got a lot to brag about. You guys have done a tremendous job, and I know it's a work in progress. It doesn't go away. You need to keep this momentum, and you're still going to be plagued with the burdens on the system because the justice system is impacted.
Absolutely.
The prisons and jails are at impasse. The DAs, the courts, probation, everybody's overloaded, and the resources are tough to come by. So I think the success that you've had is remarkable.
Yes, and, thank you very much.
I congratulate you for it. I wish you all the best, and come back and give us an update and let us know how things are going.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's Chief Chris Palmer from the Sacramento Sheriff's Department. By the way, you can check us out on Facebook Live if you're so inclined to see the chief, and we'll have more conversations with him as time goes on, I have no doubt. That's it for me, as you can tell by the sound of the music, but stick around because the lovely and talented Kitty O'Neill is coming up next with the afternoon news, and I will be back with you next week. I'm out tomorrow. Have a great one. So long.